Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Hey everyone, it's Billy Morrison and Ozzy Osbourne here. Our new show, The Madhouse Chronicles, is dropping this April. Join us as we watch and react to the maddest internet clips. What do we discuss, Ozzy?
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, all that kind of shit.
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, and all that kinds of shit. Visit osbournemediahouse.com for early access. What do you say? Do you think it's the wildest show on the internet?
Oh.
You're in the madhouse now.
Welcome to another edition of Cool Stuff Right Home. Marcus Paff and Reggie Rizzou with you. Coming up on today's episode, one UK restaurant's quest to eliminate food waste while feeding the hungry. Weird Wednesday includes a waiter and waitress race, beware the waking bears, helping a stuck skunk, and another Guinness World Record, of course. Plus, on this day in history, we look at what is considered the most chivalrous battle of all time. That's coming up. It's Cool Stuff. Well, this first story hits home for me as someone who's always held a healthy disdain for food waste. Not sure why that's something that bothers me so much, but it does. And I've consequently always made a point of either finishing what I order at a restaurant, or I box it, I take it home, and I make sure to eat it later, whether I want to eat it or not.
I'm in the same boat as you, Marcus, and there's a lot of times I plan my lunch around what is the oldest thing in the fridge that needs to get eaten for my leftovers.
I know that feeling, man.
It's not that I'm hungry for it. It's like, well, this is 5 days old. I should probably finish this off before it goes bad.
100%. I've been there and going, man, I'd much rather eat that over there, but I'm not letting this thing go to waste. It's like a personal mission. So I can totally appreciate what you're doing on that side too. Now, per The Guardian, one UK restaurant, The Long Table, has attempted to build something that both feeds the hungry while saving literal tons of food from going to waste and hitting a landfill. They've done so by creating a pay-as-you-can model that feeds all comers, regardless of ability to pay. And over the last year, they've fed about 20,000 people at below-cost price while rescuing 3.4 tons of food destined for the trash. They supplement that by paying local suppliers fair prices for their remaining needs. Now, by the way, no work at The Long Table is done by volunteers. Their venture has made enough money to employ 22 part-time and full-time staff members with hopes of replicating the model elsewhere. Long Table GM Will North told The Guardian, quote, "We are, at our simplest, a restaurant. But really what we are is an amazing restaurant where we prioritize being a real living wage employer, and we prioritize the kinds of suppliers who not only prioritize the planet, but people as well. But then what we do is, rather than charge for that, all of our meals are totally pay as you can. There's never any expectation to pay for it. That's the risk that we take," end quote. In 2024, it's estimated that 8 million adults and 3 million children are facing food insecurity in the UK. That's twice the rate of 2021. Inflation is at least in part to blame for this, with food costs soaring over the last couple of years. Hospitals have seen a significant rise in admissions for vitamin deficiencies and malnutrition, conditions doctors have described as rooted in poverty. But like other developed nations, including the US, UK farms, businesses, and households throw away 6.4 million tons of edible food every year. That's enough to feed everyone 3 meals a day for 11 weeks. That per Climate Action Group RAP. Now, if you're wondering why a Climate Action Group is interested in this particular subject, I'll let them explain. Per their website, quote, "Producing food requires significant resources, including land, energy, and water. Globally, 25 to 30% of total food produced is lost or wasted, and food waste is estimated by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change to contribute 8 to 10% of total man-made greenhouse gas emissions. If food waste were a country, it would be the world's third largest emitter after China and the USA," end quote. So aside from the obvious frustration of food being thrown out while people, children in particular, go hungry, this waste has an impact on the climate and environment. taking into account agriculture, manufacture, packaging, distribution, retail, transport, storage, and preparation costs, followed by waste treatment and disposal, food waste accounts for approximately 18 million tons of carbon emissions each year. Befitting of the name, diners at the long table sit together at long canteen-style tables in an atmosphere North describes as, quote, radical hospitality, end quote. The restaurant opens at 10 a.m. for coffee and cake. Lunch is served at noon, 5 days a week, with dinner also served on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Per North, the typical lunch feeds between 100 and 250 people, quote, and it's the kind of place that if you came and there wasn't a seat at the table, we would bring out more tables, end quote. Everyone eats the same meal, of course, no menu, but we're not necessarily talking basic dishes here either. Recent selections include dal with honey glazed carrots, that's an Indian cuisine, served with fresh flatbreads and a bread and butter pudding in sauce flavored with blue cheese. Last week, the restaurant served lasagna prepared by two chefs who previously hosted a TV cooking show together. Menus are determined by whatever ingredients are available, sourced with the idea of minimizing waste. They'll use surplus raw ingredients from local suppliers. Much comes from Fair Share, that's a national charity that redistributes surplus food, with the rest sourced from local producers. Said North, quote, we're not pro-organic, anti-organic, pro-GM, anti-GM, we're just pro-food. But it just so happens that our local producers really prioritize the planet over anything else, end quote. Reliance on surplus means meat is rarely offered at the long table, but the principles around the meat it does source is indicative of its approach. Quote, we have a rule that any animal that we buy, we have to have touched, says North. So that means we follow it from producer to abater to butcher. By the way, abater, hopefully I'm pronouncing that correctly because I have not heard the term before, it refers to a slaughterhouse. Now, except for mutton, none of the animals it cooks have been raised for slaughter. The last cow used in the restaurant had come from the National Trust's Wildflower Meadow Conservation Scheme, and it was only after she'd reached 11 years old and had arthritis that she entered the food chain. The restaurant is only part of the long table's work. At the height of the COVID pandemic, with support from local church authorities and the National Lottery, it distributed 1,000 pre-cooked frozen meals a week from a network of 20 freezers across Gloucestershire, with three quarters given to the most needy at no charge. That campaign continues on a smaller scale now that people can meet and eat together, and the focus has shifted to supporting other communities to host their own pay-as-you-can cafes, paying the cost of the food and wages of the cooks. Spinoff cafes have fed as many as 6,000 people in the past year, says North, and while the long table foots the bill, the communities running the cafes receive 100% of the donations. The long table could achieve all this because of its business structure and model. Formed as a not-for-profit community interest company, it draws income from its sales and activities. This financial year, it drew no grant funding at all. Once again, per North, quote, we turn over just about 500,000 pounds a year, referring to the monetary unit here. Next year, it should be about 550,000 pounds, and we spend about 550,000 pounds on doing it, end quote. Losses on any food are mitigated by takings from the cafe and bar and from the steady income provided by subscriptions.
I do wonder how many people go in and be like, you know what? They said pay what we want. I don't want to pay anything. Or how many people go in and be like, this is probably about $20 worth. I'll give them 20 bucks. I wonder where that kind of falls.
Yeah, I've heard of things or entities that have similar pay-as-you-can models in the past, and I suspect it falls in a wide spectrum of places where some people don't have the means or aren't willing to give up the means, and others are willing to pay a little bit more. So based on what they've seen thus far, it balances out and it works itself out and you're able to do some good in the process. So all good there. I have heard of subscription services before. If you think about just even Meals on Wheels here in the US for elderly folks, where you say, hey, put me on a plan of sorts. I want to have something coming in every day. I imagine that's what's happening here, where you're paying for the subscription. And frankly, Reg, based on what was noted in the story, it sounds like that's probably a pretty consistent source of income there. So you get enough subscriptions, you can afford to take some losses in other areas.
Yeah, that makes sense. As you were reading the story, the entire time, all I kept thinking of was the Las Vegas buffets that they have and how much waste goes into that. And it comes to my mind where you just end up with heaps of trash from food that people threw away or didn't eat.
Oh, 100%. And I, you know, I think we're like-minded in this based on what we were talking about earlier, but you go to any restaurant and you look at your neighbors And sometimes the food that isn't boxed up and that's sent back at the end of the meal, it makes me shake my head. You're going, I know. What did you have? 5 bites? And now you're sending all of this away to just be thrown in the trash without a care in the world that's not going to feed someone? In my mind, that angers me. I will be totally honest when I see that sort of thing. Take it home, find a use for it, or don't order so much food.
Give it to your dog if you have to. Just don't waste it.
Yes, absolutely. That's another option there. It's pretty frustrating to see that. And it feels like it happens mainly in developed nations who have the means to be able to do that sort of thing without thinking twice about it. All right, I feel like I'm on a soapbox now, but this is something that has always bugged me.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. By honoring your career calling, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
All right, well, we're going to start off Weird Wednesday with, I guess, the idea of food still. This one happened in Paris. It was over the weekend. France brought back a 110-year-old race to honor its waiters and waitresses after a 13-year hiatus. The first waiters race happened in 1914. It involved hundreds of waiters and waitresses dressed in their uniforms. And what they do is they carry a small pastry, an empty coffee cup, and a glass of water for a 1.25-mile loop around City Hall. So that's what they did this year as well. Van Wymeersch, the runaway winner in the women's category, as she finished in 14 minutes and 12 seconds, started waitering at the age of 16. She is now 34 and said she cannot envision any other life for herself. Quote, "I love it as much as I hate it. It's in my skin. I cannot leave it. It's hard. It's exhausting. It's demanding. It's 12 hours a day. It's no weekends. It's no Christmases." However, she added, quote, "It's part of my DNA. I grew up in a way with a tray in my hand. I have been shaped in life and in the job by the bosses who train me and the customers of all the people I have met," end quote. Now, as the waiters and waitresses will point out, the customer may always be right in other countries, but in France, the waiters and waitresses have the final word, which feeds to the reputation of them being abrupt, moody, and even rude at times. Thierry Pettit, who is now going to retire after 40 years of waiting tables, said, quote, "French pride means that in little professions like this, they don't want to be trampled on. It's not a lack of respect. Rather, it's more of a state of mind." He added, quote, "It's very Frenchy," end quote. The mayor of Paris said the cafes and restaurants are, quote, "really the soul of Paris. The bistro is where we go to meet people, where we go for our little coffee, our little drink, where we also go to argue, to love and embrace each other. The cafe and bistro are life," end quote. So why did they bring this race back now after canceling it for years due to lack of sponsors? The Olympics. They're going to be heading to Paris in July. They figure the wait staff will have a big job ahead of them when everyone comes in for the Olympics. And they figured the race of waiters and waitresses was a fitting way to celebrate the event. So Marcus, have you ever had the chance to experience the wait staff in France?
I have not, unfortunately. I'm a little embarrassed to say that. It's on my list of things I need to do in the near future, meaning just visiting France in general. But no, I haven't. Have you undergone that experience?
No, I haven't been to France yet, but my brother and his wife went recently, and they told me they didn't think the staff was rude at all. So I think that stereotype may get a little blown out of proportion.
Yeah, it may be dated too. I mean, we're in an era where hospitality is probably as popular or as big of a thing as it ever has been. Certain cities, I would imagine at least a certain portion of Paris in particular is going to be reliant on tourism to some extent, like every major American city. Certainly, I live in Las Vegas, where it's the principal driving force of the economy. So, and as hospitality becomes a big thing, big money maker for you, you would assume, hey, maybe you adapt some more pleasant attitudes.
Well, this next story for Weird Wednesday is just a big nope for me. North Carolina wildlife officials are warning people to beware of bears waking up under their houses. Like I said, nope, I'm out. Justin McVeigh, a district wildlife biologist with the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission, said over the past few years they had noticed an increase of bears making their winter homes under houses and decks. He told WGHP TV, quote, "When people think of dens, they always think of caves. That's not really the case. He added that bear dens can be crawl spaces and sometimes even just backyard brush piles. McVay said that this wasn't always the case. Quote, when I started out here 12 years ago, I may have gotten one or two calls about it. Now we probably hear about 10 to 15 of these cases, end quote. McVay also said the fun part of the job is to convince a homeowner that it's okay to have a bear under the house. Now, I don't know if I would believe him if he came to me and said, no, it's okay. The bear can be there. Don't worry about it. I'm not a fan of that. And in case you're curious, bears usually leave their dens around late March and early April. So if you happen to live in an area with a lot of bears, just beware. They seem to like being under your house or porch now.
Yeah, that would be a little creepy. And not that I hold any grudge against the bear for doing what bears do, going and finding a den. But especially if you had kids, I don't know how likely I would be to say, yeah, that's fine. He can just hang out under there. She can hang out under there for the winter. Then again, I don't know what the process of removing or moving the bear would look like, because I have a feeling said bear would be quite angry if you woke it up at that point earlier than it wanted to be.
Yeah, you don't want to poke that bear. Well, sticking with animals, here's a sticky, smelly situation I don't want to be a part of. In Ontario, wildlife authorities had to rescue a skunk after they found its head stuck in a jar of peanut butter. Brampton Animal Services said, quote, he was only looking for some food and smelled the peanut butter and unfortunately got his head stuck inside the jar, end quote. Animal Services were able to safely secure the skunk and remove its head from the jar. The skunk seemed to be in good health and was released immediately after. Now, they didn't say, though, if the responders were sprayed at all. They did add, though, in their social media post, quote, litter is an attractant to wildlife, so let's work together on keeping our communities clean to avoid these type of accidents that can be detrimental to these animals, end quote. So, Marcus, you saw a skunk with its head in a jar? Do you go and help, or what's your plan here?
Well, I'm not helping by myself, no. I mean, I would call someone, and I don't know if that's animal control or a humane society or what. I'd probably have to do some online research to figure out who the best resource would be to come and help the animal and not just trap and kill it, but allow it to get out of there. And I have to imagine these people got sprayed.
You would think so.
Self-defense, right? That's what a skunk does. You know, when you're trying to get your head out of a jar, I can't imagine the thing wasn't scared to death until they finally let it go. So yeah, I'm not helping without wearing some sort of specialized suit. I'll tell you that much, Reg.
Yeah. Or at least a lot of tomato juice ready to go, right?
Yes, prepared to jump right into that bath.
All right, we're going to wrap up Weird Wednesday with a Guinness World Record story, Houdini style. A professional escape artist started a new Guinness World Record category when he escaped a water tank in 2 minutes and 11 seconds. Andrew Basso is the first person to hold the record for escaping from a water tank while upside down and with their hands and feet restrained. In the video of the escape, which there is a link in the show notes, you can see Basso remove the handcuffs, dislocate his ankle to get his foot free, and then pick the lock at the top of the tank. Now, I didn't realize, I would assume this was a Guinness World Record a long time ago, because this isn't like a new trick. So it surprises me that this is a new record, and 2 minutes and 11 seconds. I don't know how good I would be at holding my breath that long.
Oh, I know how good I'd be. Not very. certainly not for 2 minutes, 11 seconds. I've never timed myself to know just how long I can actually do that. But I am all but certain it's not that long.
I think I start to panic at 30 seconds. And then that just leads to me freaking out and then breath getting worse. So it doesn't go well for me.
Safe to say you won't be attempting to break this record anytime soon.
No. As we pointed out many, many times, I am not risking my life for something like that.
Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com. Save big money at
Menards. Taking a look at this date in history, on March 27, 1352, the Battle of 30 was fought. It was considered one of the most chivalrous battles in history. It all started with the struggle over the succession to the Duchy of Brittany, or in France, they would call it the Duchy de Bretagne, after Duke John III died in 1341 with no clear male heir. The King of France supported Charles of Blois. His wife was the niece of Duke John III. The King of England supported John of Montfort, who was the half-brother of the Duke. Now, there were several battles over who should be the new Duke, and by 1351, there was a stalemate as neither side could beat each other. Then a proposal was made for one battle to decide the fate that would include 30 knights and squires on each side in a contest for the throne instead of thousands of soldiers. The French side commanded all Breton soldiers, while the English side had a mixed group of men. 20 were Englishmen, there were 6 German mercenaries, and 4 Bretons. The men were both mounted and on foot using lances, swords, maces, and daggers. Now, it was an intense battle, with at one point, Geoffrey de Bois told his injured French leader, John de Beaumanoir, he asked for some water, and he told his leader, quote, "Drink your blood, Beaumanoir. That will quench your thirst," end quote. So I guess no love there for your commander. At one point in the battle, though, Guillaume de Montauban, a squire fighting for Beaumanoir, mounted his horse and managed to defeat 7 English horsemen. Eventually, John of Manfort's forces emerged successful. Prisoners were taken, but they were treated well and released after the ransom was paid. Unfortunately, the Battle of 30 did not permanently resolve the conflict, as several more battles for the duchy were fought on and off throughout the years. Needless to say, though, that is kind of an interesting battle, and having just knights and squires fight to determine the outcome of the battle instead of thousands and thousands of men. And I like the fact that a squire seemed to do pretty well in this battle. Hopefully he earned his knighthood.
Yeah, I suppose you limit the number of casualties from said battle by doing it that way.
Yeah, I'm just imagining all of the other soldiers like around cheering for their side, or I don't know exactly how that went, but it'd be quite the feat to see.
Yeah, it is a bizarre dynamic when you talk about some of these traditions and things that took place in this period of time, 1352 in this instance. I can't imagine sitting anywhere and cheering on some sort of event where I knew people were going to die, but that is what happened at that time.
Different times, and you know what? I guess I'd be willing to cheer it on if it meant me and my comrades got to live.
I suppose. I don't know.
I mean,
it's hard to imagine yourself in that time when we live with the rules and the standards that we do today, put it that way. So I probably shouldn't comment because I have no idea what I'd be like if I were raised in that era.
Yeah, I mean, you don't obviously want to sit and watch people battle that out and die.
Sounds like you do, Reg. Sounds like you do.
In that era, if it was a choice between
you're going,
30
hey,
nights,
I'm good. I'm good. I'll watch it. I'm cheering it on.
I just want to go back to my farm and see my wife. That's all I'm after. I'm not looking forward to fighting this battle for some person to have more land. That's my
thought. One more day till you die of cholera.
That's right. Thanks for joining us on another edition of Cool Stuff Ride Home. if I can survive this cholera. We'll be back tomorrow with
does
more
cholera
cool stuff.
Cause coughing? I have no
I
idea.
Don't know. I don't know. I'm sure it does. Maybe I'll do the movie version. Oh no, there's blood in my handkerchief. Is that better?
Just end the show.
You can reach us at coolstuffcommute@gmail.com. Also like us and leave a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. I'm Reggie Rizzou. He's Marcus Paff. Like I said, we'll be back with more cool stuff tomorrow.